So what would you say if I told you there was no sermon today? April Fool! Not much of a joke. But my initial thoughts about this morning were to think about the trickster in religious tradition. You know, in the Egyptian pantheon with a very highly ordered society and a series of highly ordered, if genetically disordered, ruling dynasties, it's the god Set, who's the god of confusion, the god of chaos. Set rules the deserts and the storms that come in from the deserts and the foreigners who arrive from distant places. And he's problematical, of course. I mean, familiarly, it is a bit of a drag that he kills his brother, Osiris, and he's in constant competition with his nephew, Horus. Still, Set is honored, and Set, who is chaos, disorders the way things are, upsets the normal order of things, if hierarchy is normal, allows the introduction of some things that are new, some things that blow in from foreign places. Anansi is a magical character from West Africa, a spider who sometimes appears as a man, and one who is interested in gathering knowledge, bringing in to his life and into his web all the knowledge that he can trick the people who know things into revealing to him. Anansi in Africa became Kwame Anansi, and then into the Caribbean became Anansi, and then in the U.S. South became Aunt Nancy, a character who tricks people, doesn't follow the rules, misbehaves, and acquires knowledge. Anansi tricks the holders of wisdom into revealing their secrets, and the sharing of secrets is accompanied by their loss of power. And Anansi has a calabash, and he wants to pour into that calabash all the stories, all the wisdom, all the knowledge that he has. And of course, there's a time when Anansi trips on one of his legs and spills all the knowledge, but that's another story. Coyote is the trickster in the American Southwest, another sly creature who can fool the wise, even tricking the gods into sharing fire, kind of like Prometheus, right? Now, fire for Coyote is not only something that he wins through trickery, but he gives to humanity as a gift. But what a gift. What's more chaotic than fire? What's more out of control? What could potentially be more destructive? What might be helpful? The trickster gives us things that upset things. And if things are burned away, there's the possibility of something new emerging out of the purification. It's not fire that's the great chaos, but in the Gilgamesh myth, it's water. The Mesopotamian goddesses and gods are tricked by Enki, who is allowed to communicate with humans what the gods have said may not be communicated with the humans, that a great deluge is on its way. So Enki tricks the gods and goddesses by speaking in a metaphorical way that they don't understand, and as a matter of fact, most of the humans don't understand it either. Enki tells Gilgamesh and others in his foolish language that a deluge is coming, but not a deluge of water, but a deluge of birds, a deluge of fishes, a deluge of wheat and bread. And at the end of the deluge, the earth would be flattened and humanity would be wiped out. Nobody understands it. The gods and goddesses don't understand what Enki's doing, and the humans don't either, except for Gilgamesh, who's able to prepare for the flood and save his own family and save humanity, which is not a bad idea for us, against the willingness of the gods. Tricksters, whether in folk tales or religious literature or in the customs of a people, force us to look at the world in a new way. When in an episode of Topsy-Turvy, the master becomes the servant, and the servant becomes the master. When the servant acts out the master, an observant master is going to see in the depiction of himself a different way of being, a different way of doing things, a way even that might explain the injustice that some people feel. The servant's portrayal critiques the master's rule, challenges the way the world is ordered, reduces the distance between high and low. And doesn't then that foolish act by that foolish one reveal a great wisdom? That despite the assertion by the master of the distance, the great distance between high and low, that we're really one human family, one human people. There's only one family, one level of equality and dignity, one inherent value to the human spirit and the human mind and the human body. And doesn't that ask us all to behave as if that were true? I was away from you last week, and I want to share with you a couple of things I've thought about while I was away regarding the opportunities that were created by the little topsy-turvydom. Number one, it was indeed a week off. It was a week of unpaid furlough, which was a challenge for you and a challenge for me. But it was really the logical choice, the only choice our board could make and our congregation could make, considering how we're doing. It was a faithful way that the board honored the decisions of the congregation to have a budget that we would live within. It was a week off, actual week off for you and me. I didn't call you at all, and none of you called me. It became a week away. I went to Michigan, and I will say that the hours of driving out, actually I didn't drive it, I flew out the day of flying out, and then a couple of days being car-free, and then getting a big old truck. Well, it gave me a chance to have a little space. I could sleep in if I wanted to sleep in. I never did. I could stay up if I wanted to stay up. I never did that either. But it did also give me a chance to experience 85 degrees in Michigan in the last week of March, 3 days in a row. Oh, my Lord. It just happened that the 3 days that I was in Michigan were the 3 days that the magnolia opened in the backyard. And as they were relatively open when I got there. They were broadly open the second day. And the third day, they were beginning to fall. So it just happened that that was the time to be there. And for me, it was a week of saying goodbye. It was a week of packing up that house, thanking the house for the grace it had given me in my years of living there, and the earth around it that had given me such joy. Plants that I put in 3 years ago finally rooted in and are starting to reach out, and that was exciting, and I got a chance to say goodbye. Got to say goodbye to friends, got to say goodbye to neighbors. Neighbors who are so concerned that now there are only 3 families living on our house, on our street. 10 houses, only 3 families. And then it gave me time to drive away with all my junk in the back of a truck. It's all in Baltimore now. You got me. I had to think about my own theology as I was taking the last thing I did. I took the mezuzah off the door frame. And why would I have a mezuzah on my door frame? Well, I wanted to honor the house. The house had been the home of a leading Jewish family in Flint, Michigan for 60-some years. Dr. Golden and Dr. Golden and all their kids lived in that house. And when I was in Fort Lauderdale, I got a mezuzah from an artist in Florida who does this kilned glass. And she said, "Jewish or you?" And I said, can we be both? And so we rolled the Torah portion tighter and tighter, and we rolled the seven principles tighter and tighter and squeezed them both in. Jewish or you? Can we be both? I wanted to honor them. I wanted to honor the gift of care for this house. I actually named the house. In Swedish, the word for yellow is gula, and the word for gold or golden is gullana. There's a guy named Gyllenhaal. His name means golden hall. Anyway, gullana hem, which I contracted a little. So gullana hem was the name of the house, my golden home. So said some goodbye to that. Also, in taking that down, I said, I'm not Jewish. Never been Jewish. Always been who I am. And really, I'm a humanist. And just to affirm that that's the truth for me. That in spite of all of the lyrical notions about divinity and the lyrical understanding of humanity's aspiration, often that gets put in religious language. Religious language speaks to me, but at the core of it all, I'm a humanist. Somebody asked me what I thought about Jesus, and I said, well, I think he's kind of okay. It's his dad I just don't get along with. And for me to balance my atheism, really, my intellectual atheism, with a heart that's open to a lyrical expression of religion, well, that's a piece of who I am. And as I was taking that down with care and with appreciation and gratitude for that space, it was a real affirmation that I'm just a human on this human journey. And it is true that Rabbi Jesus and his crew, his homies, have been people who've formed much of who I am. And especially these clowns who didn't get it. He'd tell story after story and they didn't get it. And then we're asked to listen to those stories, but also the stories that we tell to each other, and some things we get and so much we just don't get. And yet still we sit at the table, still we come back to this place, still we are here with each other. And human to human, we affirm love. We affirm our capacity to redo. We affirm our willingness to try one more time, to forgive one more time, to forgive one more time, and to rack some things up to experience, and to say, humans with humans, there's a way we can be with each other to figure it out. I will say something that I've probably never shared with more than one or two of you, and it has to do with my Northern European ancestry. And it's not my whiteness, because I actually want to say I resigned from the white race, because there ain't none. White is a social construct. It's not a biological reality. But the social construct that I live with includes some feelings about this Northern European thing. My McHugh Irish side and my Anderson Olsen Johansson, well, you know, they weren't last names for a long time. Anyway, the Swedish side. And one of the things about aspiring to have a better sense of what it's meant to be who I am, to become who I am, was to be curious about ancestry. And so when I was in Iceland, for example, it was great to hang out with Icelandic folk musicians and to talk about the old religion. And in Iceland, of course, they say in 990, 993, in the period when the Althing accepted the new religion. They also said, it doesn't mean we're putting away with the old religion, we're just going to invite Jesus to come join Thor and Odin and others. So that accessibility toward paganism is a thing that means a lot to me. It's been wonderful for me to chat Odin stories with Laurel in the past month as we've been thinking about today. And there's a thing that I do every year, and I have for quite a while. On Halloween, the beginning of the year, I have a rune reading. And I choose a rune, or a rune chooses me. And I wonder what the meaning of that might be for my life. Now, it's not that I believe in fate. It's not that I believe that choosing that rune prescribes me in any way. But it gives me something to think about. And this year, the three runes that I chose talked about a couple things. One was about sacrifice. And not sacrifice for nothing, sacrifice for wisdom. Willingness to go the extra mile to gain a little wisdom. And I'm not sure if that's Anansi tricking a story out of someone, or Prometheus tricking fire out of the gods, but a willingness to sacrifice, to gain some strength, some wisdom, some capacity to be. I chose a stone that talked about balance. And I wondered in my life, I said, yeah, it can't just be sacrifice. There's got to be balance. So those seem to speak to each other and to me. And the third stone talked about giving. And when giving, actually putting someone in my debt and therefore getting. So I don't know that that's changed who I am as a person. But I will say, part of my soul search, part of my religious journey, is taking moments in the year to sit down and say, what's this life all about? And for me, the framing ideas of this year have been about sacrifice to gain wisdom, balance, and more interconnectedness, getting and giving, being in the circle with people. As Unitarian Universalists, all of us are responsible for our own journey, the meaning-making that we find from the lives that we live. And I believe in a place like this, we might find truths that set us free to live ethically, morally, faithfully, as we live. I did want to speak just about chaos one little second. It seems to me that each of us lives a life of some chaos. You know, the ancient Hebrew theology abhorred chaos. In the beginning, God created is the story of getting rid of chaos. Chaos is bad. Disorder is awful. We want things to be ordered like this. And so the light is here and the light is there. The day is here and the night is here. The waters above are there and the waters below are there. Earth is separated from heaven. Animals are here and birds and things that creep and crawl and swim. And at the top of them all is humanity. And of course, humanity is under God. It's all ordered. That's good. And yet what is, the Bible says, is chaos. The natural way of things is chaos. Well, chaos, as undesirable and untenable as the Bible might say, chaos is also a little difficult among ourselves. And one of the things that happened in the fall in our 2020 visioning conference was 100 of us met and a great cry came out, let's have some order. And the order that we were concerned about was some was order among ourselves, being a community that communicates better with hope, abundance, and trust, but some of it was how we approach the world. And so we've asked ourselves to be about more focused social justice action, and especially to find some partners in the world with whom we'd like to have a strategic partnership. I'm really excited that this month, after church, just about every week, you're going to have an opportunity to help us focus, to help us bring a little order to the chaos. There will be people, Alice Liam will be one, Sharon Carter will be another, and I'm sure there will be others of us who will be around a triptych that is in the parish hall. And that's going to give you a chance to put your ideas out in front of everyone about places we've been, about places we are, about places we might go. This triptych could be a place to talk about our resourcefulness, the stuff that we've accomplished that we felt good about, the stuff that individuals have done that are related to social justice action that we feel powerful about and might help us to sort through the myriad things that we could be doing, to choose the few things that we'd like to focus on for the next couple of years. I've said I don't think that we're going to find the magic pill that brings it all together, but we're going to find a few options, probably a theme, and maybe within that theme we'll begin a few projects and see which ones have legs. But in the next month, I'm hoping after church that you'll spend some time during coffee hour thinking with one another, talking with one another, turning to one another to think about what it means to be a social justice congregation at the corner of Charles and Franklin. And that is what it is about, turning to one another. Organizational consultant and chaos theorist Margaret Wheatley writes, "As we work together to restore hope to the future, we need to include a new and strange ally, our willingness to be disturbed, our willingness to have our beliefs and ideas challenged by what others think. No one person or perspective can give us the answers we need to the problems of today. And paradoxically, we can only find those answers by admitting first that we don't know. We have to be willing to let go of our certainty and expect ourselves to be confused for a time." Now, we weren't trained to admit we don't know, Wheatley continues. "Most of us were taught to sound certain and confident, to state our opinion as if it were true. We haven't been rewarded for being confused or for asking more questions than giving quick answers. We've also spent many years listening to others mainly to determine whether we agree with them or not. We don't have time or interest to sit and listen to those who think differently than we do. But the world now is quite perplexing," Wheatley says. "We no longer live in those sweet, slow days when life felt predictable, when we actually knew what we would do next. We live in a complex world. We often don't know what's going on, and we won't be able to understand its complexity unless we spend more time in not knowing." So this not knowing is really a way of saying that there are some things we do know, and yet in the topsy-turviness, in the chaos, in the incompleteness of our lives and of our experiences, it may be that we have to posit a few things and then sit back and listen to what someone else says. We may have to listen more and speak less. And so I'm hoping that this project with the triptych is also a project for all of us, of being more open to questions, to be more open and less certain, and yet to be very certain that we will get there. Heaven knows how we will get there, but we know we will as we turn to one another, create community with one another, make love with one another. We live in chaotic times in an institution that is reaching to find its generous and hopeful and trusting and life-changing self. As we engage this time of clarifying our hopes and dreams, let us play the fool. Let us be open to being surprised by the unexpected, ready to experience topsy-turvydom, to being challenged by tricksters and fools whose proposals turn us on our heads and which reveal to us a wisdom that is deep and broad and available to us all. May it be so. May it be so.